29. The problem, Jake thought, was simple. Somewhere in this dank, terrible place was a locked door. The right door. All he had to do was find it. But it was hard, because he could feel the presence in the house gathering. The sound of those dissonant, gabbling voices was beginning to merge into one sound, a low, grating whisper. And it was approaching. A door stood open to the right. Beside it, thumbtacked to the wall, was a faded daguerreotype which showed a hanged man dangling like a piece of rotten fruit from a dead tree. Beyond it was a room that had once been a kitchen. The stove was gone, but an ancient icebox, the kind with a circular refrigeration drum on top, stood on the far side of the hilly, faded linoleum. Its door gaped open. Black, smelly stuff was caked inside and had trickled down to form a long, congealed puddle on the floor. The kitchen cabinet stood open. In one, he saw what was probably the world's oldest can of Snow's clam fryettes. Poking out of another was the head of a dead rat. Its eyes were white and seemingly in motion, and after a moment Jake realized that the empty sockets were filled with squirming maggots. Something fell into his hair with a flabby thump. Jake screamed in surprise, reached for it, and grasped something that felt like a soft, bristle-covered rubber ball. He pulled it free and saw it was a spider, its bloated body the color of a fresh bruise. Its eyes regarded him with stupid malevolence. Jake threw it against the wall. It broke open and splattered there, legs twitching feebly. Another one dropped onto his neck. Jake felt a sudden painful bite just below the place where his hair stopped. He ran backward into the hall, tripped over the fallen banister, fell heavily, and felt the spider pop. Its innards, wet, feverish, and slippery, slid between his shoulder blades like warm egg yolk. Now he could see other spiders in the kitchen doorway. Some hung on almost invisible silken threads like obscene plumb bobs. Others simply dropped on the floor in a series of muddy plops and scuttered eagerly over to greet him. Jake flailed to his feet, still screaming. He felt something in his mind, something that felt like a frayed rope starting to give way. He supposed it was his sanity, and at that realization, Jake's considerable courage finally broke. He could bear this no longer, no matter what the stake. He bolted, meaning to flee if he still could, and realized too late that he had turned the wrong way and was running deeper into the mansion instead of back toward the porch. He lunged into a space too big to be a parlor or living room. It seemed to be a ballroom. Elves, with strange, sly smiles on their faces, capered on the wallpaper, peering at Jake from beneath peaked green caps. A moldy couch was pushed against one wall. In the center of the warped wooden floor was a splintered chandelier, its rusty chain lying in snarls among the spilled glass beads and dusty teardrop pendants. Jake skirted the wreck, snatching one terrified glance back over his shoulder. He saw no spiders. If not for the nastiness still trickling down his back, he might have believed he had imagined them. He looked forward again and came to a sudden skidding halt. Ahead, a pair of French doors stood half open on their recessed tracks. Another hallway stretched beyond. At the end of this second corridor stood a closed door with a golden knob. Written across the door, or perhaps carved into it, were two words. The boy. Below the doorknob was a filigreed silver plate and a keyhole. I found it, Jake thought fiercely. I finally found it. That's it. That's the door. From behind him, a low, groaning noise began, as if the house was beginning to tear itself apart. Jake turned and looked back across the ballroom. The wall on the far side of the room had begun to swell outward, pushing the ancient couch ahead of it. The old wallpaper shuddered, the elves began to ripple and dance. In places, the paper simply snapped upward in long curls, like window shades which have been released too suddenly. The plaster bulged forward in a pregnant curve. From beneath it, Jake could hear dry, snapping sounds as the laughing broke, rearranging itself into some new, as-yet-hidden shape. And still the sound increased, only it was no longer precisely a groan. Now it sounded like a snarl. He stared, hypnotized, unable to pull his eyes away. The plaster didn't crack and then vomit outward in chunks. It seemed to have become plastic. And as the wall continued to bulge, making an irregular white bubble shape from which scraps and draggles of wallpaper still hung, the surface began to mold itself into hills and curves and valleys. Suddenly Jake realized he was looking at a huge plastic face that was pushing itself out of the wall. It was like looking at someone who has walked headfirst into a wet sheet. There was a loud snap as a chunk of broken lath tore free of the rippling wall. It became the jagged pupil of one eye. Below it, the wall writhed into a snarling mouth filled with jagged teeth. Jake could see fragments of wallpaper clinging to its lips and gums. One plaster hand tore free of the wall, trailing an unraveling bracelet of rotted electrical wire. It grasped the sofa and threw it aside, leaving ghostly white finger marks on its dark surface. More lathing burst free as the plaster fingers flexed. They created sharp, splintery claws. Now the face was all the way out of the wall and staring at Jake with its one wooden eye. Above it, in the center of its forehead, one wallpaper elf still danced. It looked like a weird tattoo. There was a wrenching sound as the thing began to slide forward. The hall doorway tore out and became a hunched shoulder. The thing's one free hand clawed across the floor, spraying glass droplets from the fallen chandelier. Jake's paralysis broke. He turned, lunged through the French doors, and pelted down the second length of hallway with his pack bouncing and his right hand groping for the key in his pocket. His heart was a runaway factory machine in his chest. Behind him, the thing which was crawling out of the mansion's woodwork bellowed at him, and although there were no words, Jake knew what it was saying. It was telling him to stand still, telling him that it was useless to run, telling him there was no escape. The whole house now seemed alive. The air resounded with splintering wood and squalling beams. The humming, insane voice of the doorkeeper was everywhere. Jake's hand closed on the key. As he brought it out, one of the notches caught in the pocket. His fingers, wet with sweat, slipped. The key fell to the floor, bounced, dropped through a crack between two warped boards, and disappeared. "30. "He's in trouble!" Susanna heard Eddie shout, but the sound of his voice was distant. She had plenty of trouble herself, but she thought she might be doing okay just the same.
"I'm gonna melt that icicle sugar," she had told the demon. "I'm gonna melt it, and when it's gone, what you gonna do then?"
She hadn't melted it exactly, but she had changed it. The thing inside her was certainly giving her no pleasure, but at least the terrible pain had subsided, and it was no longer cold. It was trapped, unable to disengage. Nor was she holding it in with her body, exactly. Roland had said sex was its weakness as well as its weapon, and he had been right as usual. It had taken her, but she had also taken it, and now it was as if each of them had a finger stuck in one of those fiendish Chinese tubes where yanking only sticks you tighter. She hung on to one idea for dear life, had to, because all other conscious thought had vanished. She had to hold this sobbing, frightened, vicious thing in the snare of its own helpless lust. It wriggled and thrust and convulsed within her, screaming to be let go, at the same time it used her body with greedy, helpless intensity, but she would not let it go free.
"And what's going to happen when I finally do let it go?" she wondered desperately. "What's it going to do to pay me back?"
She didn't know. 31. The rain was falling in sheets, threatening to turn the circle within the stones into a sea of mud.
"Hold something over the door," Eddie shouted. "Don't let the rain wash it out."
Roland snatched a glance at Susanna and saw she was still struggling with the demon. Her eyes were half shut, her mouth pulled down in a harsh grimace. He could not see or hear the demon, but he could sense its angry, frightened thrashings.
Eddie turned his streaming face toward him. "Did you hear me?" he shouted. "Get something over the goddamn door and do it now!" Roland yanked one of their hides from his pack and held a corner in each hand. Then he stretched his arms out and leaned over Eddie, creating a makeshift tent. The tip of Eddie's homemade pencil was caked with mud. He wiped it across his arm, leaving a smear the color of bitter chocolate, then wrapped his fist around the stick again and bent over his drawing. It was not exactly the same size as the door on Jake's side of the barrier. The ratio was perhaps 0.75 to 1, but it would be big enough for Jake to come through, if the keys worked. "If he even has a key, isn't that what you mean?" he asked himself. "Suppose he's dropped it. Or that house made him drop it." He drew a plate under the circle which represented the doorknob, hesitated, and then squiggled the familiar shape of a keyhole within it. He hesitated. There was one more thing. But what? It was hard to think of, because it felt as if there were a tornado roaring through his head, a tornado with random thoughts flipping around inside it, instead of uprooted barns and privies and chicken houses. "Come on, sugar!" Susanna cried from behind him. "You weakening on me. What's the matter? I thought you were some kind of hot shit stud boy." Boy. That was it. Carefully, he wrote "the boy" across the top panel of the door with the tip of his stick. At the instant he finished the Y, the drawing changed. The circle of rain-darkened earth he had drawn suddenly darkened even more, and pushed up from the ground, becoming a dark, gleaming knob. And instead of brown, wet earth within the shape of the keyhole, he could see dim light. Behind him, Susanna shrieked at the demon again, urging it on, but now she sounded as if she were tiring. This had to end, and soon. Eddie bent forward from the waist like a Muslim saluting Allah and put his eye to the keyhole he had drawn. He looked through it into his own world, into that house which he and Henry had gone to see in May of 1977, unaware, except he, Eddie, had not been unaware, no, not totally unaware, even then, that a boy from another part of the city was following them. He saw a hallway. Jake was down on his hands and knees, tugging frantically at a board. Something was coming for him. Eddie could see it, but at the same time he could not. It was as if part of his brain refused to see it, as if seeing would lead to comprehension, and comprehension to madness. "Hurry up, Jake!" he screamed into the keyhole. "For Christ's sake, move it!" Above the speaking ring, thunder ripped the sky like cannon fire, and the rain turned to hail. 32. For a moment after the key fell, Jake only stood where he was, staring down at the narrow crack between the boards. Incredibly, he felt sleepy. "That shouldn't have happened," he thought. "It's one thing too much. I can't go on with this. Not one minute, not one single second longer. I'm going to curl up against that door instead. I'm going to go to sleep right away, all at once. And when it grabs me and pulls me toward its mouth, I'll never wake up." Then the thing coming out of the wall grunted, and when Jake looked up, his urge to give in vanished in a single stroke of terror. Now it was all the way out of the wall, a giant plaster head with one broken wooden eye and one reaching plaster hand. Chunks of lathing stood out on its skull in random hackles like a child's drawing of hair. It saw Jake and opened its mouth, revealing jagged wooden teeth. It grunted again. Plaster dust drifted out of its yawning mouth like cigar smoke. Jake fell to his knees and peered into the crack. The key was a small, brave shimmer of silvery light down there in the dark, but the crack was far too narrow to admit his fingers. He seized one of the boards and yanked with all his might. The nails which held it groaned, but held. There was a jangling crash. He looked down the hallway and saw the hand, which was bigger than his whole body, seize the fallen chandelier and throw it aside. The rusty chain which had once held it suspended rose like a bullwhip and then came down with a heavy crump. A dead lamp on a rusty chain rattled above Jake, dirty glass chattering against ancient brass. The doorkeeper's head, attached only to its single hunched shoulder and reaching arm, slid forward above the floor. Behind it, the remains of the wall collapsed in a cloud of dust.
A moment later, the fragments humped up and became the creature's twisted, bony back. The doorkeeper saw Jake looking and seemed to grin. As it did, splinters of wood poked out of its wrinkling cheeks. It dragged itself forward through the dust-hazed ballroom, mouth opening and closing. Its great hand groped amid the ruins, feeling for purchase, and ripped one of the French doors at the end of the hall from its track. Jake screamed breathlessly and began to wrench at the board again. It wouldn't come, but the gunslinger's voice did. "The other one, Jake. Try the other one." He let go of the board he had been yanking at and grabbed the one on the other side of the crack. As he did, another voice spoke. He heard this one not in his head but with his ears, and understood it was coming from the other side of the door he had been looking for ever since the day he hadn't been run over in the street. "Hurry up, Jake! For Christ's sake, hurry up!" When he yanked this other board, it came free so easily that he almost tumbled over backward. 33. Two women were standing in the doorway of the used appliance shop across the street from the mansion. The older was the proprietor. The younger had been her only customer when the sounds of crashing walls and breaking beams began. Now, without knowing they were doing it, they linked arms about each other's waists and stood that way, trembling like children who hear a noise in the dark. Up the street, a trio of boys on their way to the Dutch Hill Little League field stood, gaping at the house, their red ball flyer wagon filled with baseball equipment forgotten behind them. A delivery driver nosed his van into the curb and got out to look. The patrons of Henry's Corner Market and the Dutch Hill Pub came straggling up the street, looking around wildly. Now the ground began to tremble, and a fan of fine cracks started to spread across Reinhold Street.
"Is it an earthquake?"
the delivery van driver shouted at the women standing outside the appliance shop. But instead of waiting for an answer, he jumped back behind the wheel of his van and drove away rapidly, swerving to the wrong side of the street to keep away from the ruined house which was the epicenter of this convulsion. The entire house seemed to be bowing inward. Boards splintered, jumped off its face, and rained down into the yard. Dirty, gray-black waterfalls of slate shingles poured down from the eaves. There was an ear-splitting bang, and a long, zigzagging crack shot down the center of the mansion. The door disappeared into it, and then the whole house began to swallow itself from the outside in. The younger woman suddenly broke the older one's grip.
"I'm getting out of here,"
she said, and began to run up the street without looking back. 34. A hot, strange wind began to sigh down the hallway, blowing Jake's sweaty hair back from his brow as his fingers closed over the silver key. He now understood, on some instinctive level, what this place was and what was happening. The doorkeeper was not just in the house. It was the house. Every board, every shingle, every windowsill, every eave. And now it was pushing forward, becoming some crazily jumbled representation of its true shape as it did. It meant to catch him before he could use the key. Beyond the giant white head and the crooked, hulking shoulder, he could see boards and shingles and wire and bits of glass, even the front door and the broken banister, flying up the main hall and into the ballroom, joining the form which bulked there, creating more and more of the misshapen plaster man that was even now groping toward him with its freakish hand. Jake yanked his own hand out of the hole in the floor and saw it was covered with huge, trundling beetles. He slapped it against the wall to knock them off and cried out as the wall first opened and then tried to close around his wrist. He yanked his hand free just in time, whirled, and jammed the silver key into the hole in the plate. The plaster man roared again, but its voice was momentarily drowned out by a harmonic shout which Jake recognized. He had heard it in the vacant lot, but it had been quiet then, perhaps dreaming. Now it was an unequivocal cry of triumph. That sense of certainty, overwhelming, inarguable, filled him again, and this time he felt sure there would be no disappointment. He heard all the affirmation he needed in that voice. It was the voice of the rose. The dim light in the hallway was blotted out as the plaster hand tore away the other French door and squeezed into the corridor. The face socked itself into the opening above the hand, peering at Jake. The plaster fingers crawled toward him like the legs of a huge spider. Jake turned the key and felt a sudden surge of power rush up his arm. He heard a heavy, muffled thump as the locked bolt inside withdrew. He seized the knob, turned it, and yanked the door open. It swung wide. Jake cried out in confused horror as he saw what lay behind. The doorway was blocked with earth from top to bottom and side to side. Roots poked out like bunches of wire. Worms, seeming as confused as Jake was himself, crawled hither and thither on the door-shaped pack of dirt. Some dived back into it, others only went on crawling about, as if wondering where the earth which had been below them a moment ago had gone. One dropped onto Jake's sneaker. The keyhole shape remained for a moment, shedding a spot of misty white light on Jake's shirt. Beyond it, so close, so out of reach, he could hear rain and a muffled boom of thunder across an open sky. Then the keyhole shape was also blotted out, and gigantic plaster fingers curled around Jake's lower leg. 35. Eddie did not feel the sting of the hail as Roland dropped the hide, got to his feet, and ran to where Susanna lay. The gunslinger grabbed her beneath the arms and dragged her, as gently and carefully as he could, across to where Eddie crouched. "Let it go when I tell you, Susanna," Roland shouted. "Do you understand? When I tell you!" Eddie saw and heard none of this. He heard only Jake screaming faintly on the other side of the door. The time had come to use the key. He pulled it out of his shirt and slid it into the keyhole he had drawn. He tried to turn it. The key would not turn, not so much as a millimeter. Eddie lifted his face to the pelting hail, oblivious to the ice balls which struck his forehead and cheeks and lips, leaving welts and red blotches. "No!" he howled. "Oh, God, please, no!" But there was no answer from God. Only another crash of thunder and a streak of lightning across a sky now filled with racing clouds. 36. Jake lunged upward, grabbed the chain of the lamp which hung above him, and ripped free of the doorkeeper's clutching fingers. He swung backward, used the packed earth in the doorway to push off, and then swung forward again like Tarzan on a vine. He raised his legs and kicked out at the clutching fingers as he closed on them. Plaster exploded in chunks, revealing a crudely jointed skeleton of lathing beneath. The plaster man roared, a sound of intermingled hunger and rage. Beneath that cry, Jake could hear the whole house collapsing, like the one in that story of Edgar Allan Poe. He pendulumed back on the chain, struck the wall of packed earth which blocked the doorway, then swung forward again. The hand reached up for him, and he kicked at it wildly, legs scissoring. He felt a stab of pain in his foot as those wooden fingers clutched. When he swung back again, he was minus a sneaker. He tried for a higher grip on the chain, found it, and began to shinny up toward the ceiling. There was a muffled, creaking thud above him. Fine plaster dust had begun to sift down on his upturned, sweating face. The ceiling had begun to sag. The lamp chain was pulling out of it a link at a time. There was a thick, crunching sound from the end of the hallway as the plaster man finally pushed its hungry face through the opening. Jake swung helplessly back toward that face, screaming. 37. Eddie's terror and panic suddenly fell away. The cloak of coldness dropped over him, a cloak Roland of Gilead had worn many times. It was the only armor the true gunslinger possessed, and all such a one needed. At the same moment a voice spoke in his mind. He had been haunted by such voices over the last 3 months, his mother's voice, Roland's voice, and of course Henry's. But this one he recognized with relief was his own. and it was at last calm and rational and courageous. You saw the shape of the key in the fire. You saw it again in the wood, and both times you saw it perfectly. Later on, you put a blindfold of fear over your eyes. Take it off. Take it off and look again. It may not be too late, even now. He was faintly aware that the gunslinger was staring at him grimly, faintly aware that Susanna was shrieking at the demon in a fading but still defiant voice, faintly aware that on the other side of the door, Jake was screaming in terror. Or was it now agony? Eddie ignored them all. He pulled the wooden key out of the keyhole he had drawn, out of the door, which was now real, and looked at it fixedly, trying to recapture the innocent delight he had sometimes known as a child, the delight of seeing a coherent shape hidden in senselessness. And there it was, the place he'd gone wrong, so clearly visible he couldn't understand how he'd missed it in the first place. "I really must have been wearing a blindfold," he thought. It was the S-shape at the end of the key, of course. The second curve was a bit too fat, just a tiny bit. "Knife," he said, and held out his hand like a surgeon in an operating room. Roland slapped it into his palm without a word. Eddie gripped the top of the blade between the thumb and first finger of his right hand. He bent over the key, unmindful of the hail which pelted his unprotected neck, and the shape in the wood stood out more clearly, stood out with its own lovely and undeniable reality. He scraped. Once. Delicately. A single sliver of ash, so thin it was almost transparent, curled up from the belly of the S-shape at the end of the key. On the other side of the door, Jake Chambers shrieked again. 38. The chain let go with a rattling crash, and Jake fell heavily, landing on his knees. The doorkeeper roared in triumph. The plaster hand seized Jake about his hips and began to drag him down the hall. He stuck his legs out in front of him and planted his feet, but it did no good. He felt splinters and rust-blunted nails digging into his skin as the hand tightened its grip and continued to drag him forward. The face appeared to be stuck just inside the entrance to the hallway like a cork in a bottle. The pressure it had exerted to get in that far had squeezed the rudimentary features into a new shape, that of some monstrous, malformed troll. The mouth yawned open to receive him. Jake groped madly for the key, wanting to use it as some last-ditch talisman, but of course he had left it in the door. "You son of a bitch!" he screamed, and threw himself backward with all his strength, bowing his back like an Olympic diver, unmindful of the broken boards which dug into him like a belt of nails. He felt his jeans slide down on his hips, and the grip of the hand slipped momentarily. Jake lunged again. The hand clenched brutally, but Jake's jeans slid down to his knees, and his back slammed to the floor with the pack to cushion the blow. The hand loosened, perhaps wanting to secure a firmer grip upon its prey. Jake was able to draw his knees up a little, and when the hand tightened again, Jake drove his legs forward. The hand yanked backward at the same time, and what Jake had hoped for happened. His jeans and his remaining sneaker were peeled from his body, leaving him free again, at least for the moment. He saw the hand rotate on his wrist of boards and disintegrating plaster and jam his dungarees into his mouth. Then he was crawling back toward the blocked doorway on his hands and knees, oblivious of the glass fragments from the fallen lamp, wanting only to get his key again. He had almost reached the door when the hand closed over his naked legs and began to pull him back once more. 39. The shape was there now, finally all there. Eddie put the key back into the keyhole and applied pressure. For a moment there was resistance, and then it revolved beneath his hand. He heard the locking mechanism turn, heard the bar pull back, felt the key crack in two the moment it had served its purpose. He grasped the dark, polished knob with both hands and pulled. There was a sense of great weight wheeling on an unseen pivot, a feeling that his arm had been gifted with boundless strength, and a clear knowledge that two worlds had suddenly come in contact, and a way had been opened between them. He felt a moment of dizziness and disorientation, and as he looked through the doorway, he realized why. Although he was looking down, vertically, he was seeing horizontally. It was like a strange optical illusion created with prisms and mirrors. Then he saw Jake being pulled backward down the glass and plaster-littered hallway, elbows dragging, calves pinned together by a giant hand. And he saw the monstrous mouth which awaited him, fuming some white fog that might have been either smoke or dust.
"Roland!" Eddie shouted. "Roland, it's got him!"
Then he was knocked aside. 40. Susanna was aware of being hauled up and whirled around. The world was a carousel blur, standing stones, gray sky, hailstone-littered ground, and a rectangular hole that looked like a trapdoor in the ground. Screams drifted up from it. Within her, the demon raved and struggled, wanting only to escape, but helpless to do so until she allowed it.
"Now!" Roland was shouting. "Let it go now, Susanna! For your father's sake, let it go now!"
And she did. She had, with Detta's help, constructed a trap for it in her mind, something like a net of woven rushes, and now she cut them. She felt the demon fly back from her at once, and there was an instant of terrible hollowness, terrible emptiness. These feelings were at once overshadowed by relief and a grim sense of nastiness and defilement. As its invisible weight fell away, she glimpsed it, an inhuman shape like a manta ray, with huge curling wings and something that looked like a cruel baling hook curving out and up from beneath. She saw, sensed the thing flash above the open hole in the ground, saw Eddie looking up with wide eyes, saw Roland spread his arms wide to catch the demon. The gunslinger staggered back, almost knocked off his feet by the unseen weight of the demon. Then he rocked forward again with an armload of nothing. Clutching it, he jumped through the doorway and was gone. 41. Sudden white light flooded the hallway of the mansion. Hailstones struck the walls and bounced up from the broken boards of the floor. Jake heard confused shouts, then saw the gunslinger come through. He seemed to leap through as if he had come from above. His arms were held out far in front of him, the tips of the fingers locked. Jake felt his feet slide into the doorkeeper's mouth.
"Roland!" he shrieked. "Roland, help me!"
The gunslinger's hands parted, and his arms were immediately thrown wide. He staggered backward. Jake felt serrated teeth touch his skin, ready to tear flesh and grind bone, and then something huge rushed over his head like a gust of wind. A moment later, the teeth were gone. The hand which had pinned his legs together relaxed. He heard an unearthly shriek of pain and surprise begin to issue from the doorkeeper's dusty throat, and then it was muffled, crammed back. Roland grabbed Jake and hauled him to his feet.
"You came!" Jake shouted. "You really came!"
"I came, yes. By the grace of the gods and the courage of my friends, I came."
As the doorkeeper roared again, Jake burst into tears of relief and terror. Now the house sounded like a ship foundering in a heavy sea. Chunks of wood and plaster fell all around them. Roland swept Jake into his arms and ran for the door. The plaster hand, groping wildly, struck one of his booted feet and spun him into the wall, which again tried to bite. Roland pushed forward, turned, and drew his gun. He fired twice into the aimlessly thrashing hand, vaporizing one of the crude plaster fingers. Behind them, the face of the doorkeeper had gone from white to a dingy, purplish black, as if it were choking on something, something which had been fleeing so rapidly that it had entered the monster's mouth and jammed in its gullet before it realized what it was doing. Roland turned again and ran through the doorway. Although there was now no visible barrier, he was stopped cold for a moment, as if an unseen meshwork had been drawn across the chair. Then he felt Eddie's hands in his hair, and he was yanked not forward, but upward. 42. They emerged into wet air and slackening hail like babies being born. Eddie was the midwife, as the gunslinger had told him he must be. He was sprawled forward on his chest and belly, his arms out of sight in the doorway, his hands clutching fistfuls of Roland's hair.
"Suze, help me!"
She wriggled forward, reached through, and groped a hand under Roland's chin.
He came up to her with his head cocked backward and his lips parted in a snarl of pain and effort. Eddie felt a tearing sensation, and one of his hands came free, holding a thick lock of the gunslinger's gray-streaked hair.
"He's slipping! This motherfucker ain't nowhere!"
Susanna gasped, and gave a terrific wrench as if she meant to snap Roland's neck. Two small hands shot out of the doorway in the center of the circle and clutched one of the edges. Freed of Jake's weight, Roland got an elbow up, and a moment later he was boosting himself out. As he did it, Eddie grabbed Jake's wrists and hauled him up. Jake rolled onto his back and lay there, panting. Eddie turned to Susanna, took her in his arms, and began to rain kisses on her forehead, cheeks, and neck. He was laughing and crying at the same time. She clung to him, breathing hard, but there was a small, satisfied smile on her lips, and one hand slipped over Eddie's wet hair in slow, contented strokes. From below them came a cauldron of black sounds, squeals, grunts, thuds, crashes. Roland crawled away from the hole with his head down. His hair stood up in a wild wad. Threads of blood trickled down his cheeks.
"Shut it," he gasped at Eddie. "Shut it for your father's sake."
Eddie got the door moving, and those vast unseen hinges did the rest. The door fell with a gigantic, toneless bang, cutting off all sound from below. As Eddie watched, the lines that had marked its edges faded back to smudged marks in the dirt. The doorknob lost its dimension and was once more only a circle he'd drawn with a stick. Where the keyhole had been, there was only a crude shape with a chunk of wood sticking out of it, like the hilt of a sword from a stone. Susanna went to Jake and pulled him gently to a sitting position.
"You all right, sugar?"
He looked at her dazedly.
"Yes, I think so. Where is he? The gunslinger. There's something I have to ask him."
"I'm here, Jake," Roland said. He got to his feet, drunk walked over to Jake and hunkered beside him. He touched the boy's smooth cheek almost unbelievingly.
"You won't let me drop this time?"
"No," Roland said. "Not this time. Not ever again." But in the deepest darkness of his heart, he thought of the tower and wondered. 43. The hail changed to a hard, driving rain, but Eddie could see gleams of blue sky behind the unraveling clouds in the north. The storm was going to end soon, but in the meantime they were going to get drenched. He found he didn't mind. He could not remember when he had felt so calm, so at peace with himself, so utterly drained. This mad adventure wasn't over yet. He suspected, in fact, that it had barely begun. But today they had won a big one. "Suze?" He pushed her hair away from her face and looked into her dark eyes. "Are you okay? Did it hurt you?"
"Hurt me a little, but I'm okay.
I think that bitch Dedawaka is still the undefeated Roadhouse champion, demon or no demon." "What's that mean?" She grinned impishly.
"Not much. Not anymore, thank God. How about you, Eddie, all right?"
Eddie listened for Henry's voice and didn't hear it. He had an idea that Henry's voice might be gone for good.
"Even better than that," he said, and laughing, folded her into his arms again.
Over her shoulder he could see what was left of the door, only a few faint lines and angles. Soon the rain would wash those away, too. 44.
"What's your name?"
Jake asked the woman, whose legs stopped just above the knee. He was suddenly aware that he had lost his pants in his struggle to escape the doorkeeper, and he pulled the tail of his shirt down over his underwear. There wasn't very much left of her dress, either, as far as that went.
"Susanna Dean," she said. "I already know your name."
"Susanna," Jake said thoughtfully.
"I don't suppose your father owns a railroad company, does he?"
She looked astonished for a moment, then threw her head back and laughed.
"Why, no, sugar, he was a dentist who went and invented a few things and got rich. What makes you ask a thing like that?"
Jake didn't answer. He had turned his attention to Eddie. The terror had already left his face, and his eyes had regained that cool, assessing look which Roland remembered so well from the way station. "Hi, Jake," Eddie said. "Good to see you, man."
"Hi," Jake said. "I met you earlier today, but you were a lot younger then."
"I was a lot younger 10 minutes ago. Are you okay?"
"Yes," Jake said. "Some scratches, that's all."
He looked around.
"You haven't found the train yet."
This was not a question. Eddie and Susanna exchanged puzzled looks, but Roland only shook his head. "No train."
"Are your voices gone?"
Roland nodded. "All gone. Yours?"
"Gone. I'm all together again. We both are."
They looked at the same instant, with the same impulse. As Roland swept Jake into his arms, the boy's unnatural self-possession broke, and he began to cry. It was the exhausted, relieved weeping of a child who has been lost long, suffered much, and is finally safe again. As Roland's arms closed about his waist, Jake's own arms slipped about the gunslinger's neck and gripped like hoops of steel.
"I'll never leave you again," Roland said, and now his own tears came. "I swear to you, on the names of all my fathers, I'll never leave you again."
Yet his heart, that silent, watchful, lifelong prisoner of Ka, received the words of this promise not just with wonder, but with doubt.